totally amazed me when I first read it. He had tracked down and acquired so many beautiful artistic objects connected with football that I had never once thought of looking out for, such as paintings, drawings, prints, ceramics, games, toys, along with the more obvious football memorabilia like boots and balls. He had gone right back to the beginning of football, back to the foundation in London of the FA in 1863, when the rules were codified for the first time, the rules that the rest of the world went on to adopt. And even further back, to the evidence for some sort of football games having been played in ancient China and Japan, and in 16th century Italy. He was collecting these sorts of historic and artistic football treasures and documents at a time when no one else seemed to be aware of their value and importance, or even of their existence. Although gradually they did become aware once the big auction houses like Christie's and Sotheby's started regular football sales in the 1990s. Harry Langton's ambition was that his collection should be kept together and made the basis of a national football museum in Britain. It was discussed from the mid-1990s onwards, but looked unlikely to happen, for lack of money, and also because of disagreements about where such a museum should be located. Several museums in other countries were interested in acquiring the collection. Despite the collection being largely English, football, of course, now belongs to the world, and its origins and history and treasures are of interest everywhere. The possibility of it leaving these shores for good did help galvanise the campaign for a national football museum in England. In the end, it came to pass, at a total cost of £15 million, out of which £9.3 million came from the Heritage Lottery Fund. The collection was bought, and brand new premises built, and the museum opened in February 2001. Too late, alas, for Harry Langton to see it. He had died the previous year. How it came to be located in Preston is a saga in itself, but it was a huge coup for the town and all the action groups and deputations behind the campaign. The government liked the idea of a national museum, of which there are 20 or so in all, not being in London for a change, but up in the northwest. Real football fans will know the importance of the northwest in the history of football, as the early professional clubs that formed the world's first football league in 1888 were mostly based up there or in the Midlands, not in London and the South. And really true fans will know that Preston played a pretty big role in the early years of football. Preston North End was a founder of that first league and ran away with the title in the first year, thus becoming known as the Invincibles. And Deepdale, the home of Preston North End, is now the oldest football league ground in the world. Preston have played there continuously since 1881, the year they were formed. Notts County is our oldest existing professional club, founded in 1862, but they have had several different grounds in their history. The museum was built as an integral part of Deepdale, located under the new stand when the ground was being redeveloped in 2000. I went to visit it in the summer of 2009, getting a taxi from Preston Station, which was a pretty depressing experience. I don't know the town, perhaps there was a scenic route I missed, but there seemed to be so many buildings closed or derelict, such as the Passion Palace, what passions could once have gone on there, and the Ethical Spiritual Church, also boarded up, though perhaps its spirits were hovering elsewhere. There was lots of action and excitement around the museum itself, which was reassuring. It was getting towards the end of the summer holidays, and many families were clearly taking the chance to have a fun day out, and all for free. The first thing to see down a long corridor was a football hall of fame, where they put up large portraits of famous players and managers who have achieved this accolade, awarded by the museum itself. I couldn't quite work out the rationale, but a new batch gets announced every year and a big fuss is made, or so they hope. Being in Preston, they have to work hard to make any sort of fuss, as the English media is so London-orientated. One area was devoted to kids' activities, where lots of families were sitting painting or decorating dishes with football stars and scenes. There were quizzes and questions on the wall for them to answer, and a Sabutio game they could play. All very popular, attracting lots of children. I caught sight of a large photograph of the Beatles on one wall. How had they dragged them in? Then I read a quiz question underneath. Who was known as the fifth Beatle? Answer, George Best. I suppose it is as good a way as any of introducing a player whom modern kids might not have heard of. Elsewhere in the museum, children were allowed to dress up in ancient strips and have their photographs taken. And upstairs, there were lots of interactive attractions for slightly older kids, such as taking penalties. At the heart of the museum, which is what I had come to see and ogle at, are the real objects, the genuine historic artifacts, so many of them, and so well displayed and explained. I could have stayed for days, weeks even, without properly exhausting them all. They have some 2,000 items on show at any one time, with another 30,000 behind the scenes for researchers and academics to study. 40 years ago, doing a degree in football would have been laughable, as silly and unlikely as, say, doing a degree in vintage radios, fans, lawnmowers, or the Beatles. Now both football and the Beatles, which just happen to be my fave collecting areas, are studied at universities all over the world. Lawnmowers, alas, have yet to make it. In the case of football, there are now 50 universities in the UK where you can get a first degree or a postgraduate degree in football. Who would have thought it? The National Football Museum is the prime research venue to which students come, not just from England, but from all over the world. Scotland has its own very good museum of football, located at Hampden Park, and one recently opened in Brazil. There's also one in Norway. That's about it so far on the national level, but in the UK there are 7 leading clubs with their own museums, including Manchester United, Liverpool, Arsenal, Chelsea, West Ham, Newcastle and Celtic, with another 4 being planned. We football collectors are really spoiled. Since the National Football Museum opened, many other valuable collections have been acquired, gifted or loaned, along with hundreds of humbler items provided by members of the public. One of the biggest acquisitions in recent years is called the Priory Collection. I kept on seeing that name in the credit line on many labels as I wandered round, but the donor, when he handed it over, wished to remain anonymous. I now gather it was Nigel Ray, the owner of Saracens Rugby Club, who is a keen collector of all sporting memorabilia. Naturally enough, the museum has lots of 19th century balls from the early years of football, some in very odd shapes, used by public schools like Harrow, before the balls were standardised and the rules codified. And also balls from famous cup finals, and from the very first World Cup final in 1930. Uruguay and Argentina played each other in the final, and each side insisted on playing with their own ball. A compromise was reached whereby the Argentinian ball was used in the first half, and the Uruguayan in the second. Argentina were ahead with their ball at half-time, 2-1, but Uruguay went on to win 4-2 with their ball, which proves something. Or could just be balls. For several years, the museum had on show the Argentinian ball. When the Priory Collection was offered, it turned out to contain the other ball. So now, after all these decades, they have both 1930 World Cup final balls on show together. They do in fact look marginally different, with the leather panels in slightly different patterns. Amongst their football shirts is the oldest surviving shirt, part of the Langton collection. It was worn by Arnold Kirk Smith, playing for England in the world's first ever international, against Scotland in 1872, which ended in a 0-0 draw. They also have Bobby Moore's 1970 World Cup shirt with the number 6 on the back. He swapped it after that game with Pelé, and for many years it was on display in a Brazilian bar before coming on the market and ending up at the museum. If you look carefully, you can still see the tobacco stains. From the bar, of course, not from Bobby, as he was our blue-eyed, clean-living hero. Other famous shirts include the one Maradona was wearing in the 1986 World Cup when he scored the so-called Hand of God goal against England, and also Stanley Matthews's shirt from the 1953 Cup Final, still known as the Matthews Final. The day I was there, they had a special display of Matthews' memorabilia, which included a pair of his boots dated 1953. I was surprised to see how small and light they were, without the usual ankle protection pads of the period, the sort I thought everyone in Britain used at that time, including the professionals. I'd always believed that so-called continental boots, which real men dismissed as being more like slippers, did not come in till the 1970s. But apparently, after playing in the World Cup in 1950 in Brazil, Matthews had acquired for himself a pair of the latest lightweights. There was also a special display of items belonging to Sir Tom Finney, one of Preston North End's greatest ever stars. Apart from boots, shirts and programmes, his knighthood medal was on display. In a display of Tommy Lawton memorabilia, another of the all-time English greats, they also had his ashes in a special cask. One personal item that intrigues and rather shocks the younger generation is the large and rather cruel-looking neck brace, once worn by Bert Troutman. He was Manchester City's heroic goalkeeper in the 1956 Cup Final, who played on, helping them to gain victory, not realising he had broken his neck. Troutman was a German, held in a prisoner of war camp during the war, which in the end proved to be to his advantage. The FA at the time insisted on stringent residential qualifications for foreigners before they could play for a league team, but it was judged that Troutman's years as a POW gave him residency. One of the more recently arrived oddball items is a coracle. They have it near the entrance, a small, black-painted boat tipped up on its side. What on earth could that have to do with football? Shows how much I know. It's world famous, at least among Shrewsbury Town supporters. For decades, it was the job of a man called Fred Davis to jump into this little boat whenever a ball went into the nearby river and retrieve it. When their ground moved from Gay Meadow, where they had been since 1910, into a new stadium in 2007, the coracle was no longer required. I was particularly interested in all their items to do with Dick Carr's women's team, as I have my own little collection of women's football. People think women playing football, which is now incredibly popular all over the world, is a modern phenomenon, but its origins go back to 1895, when the British Ladies Football Club was formed and they held their first matches. As with the men's game, the early players were from the upper classes, public school and county types, but then the working classes arrived and took over. For the women, the spur was the First World War, when 1 million women went into munitions factories and started their own works football teams, just as the men had done. One of the most successful was Dick Carr's ladies, who came from Preston. I'd always assumed there must have been a man called Dick Carr, but it refers to two men who had founded a Preston factory, a Mr. Dick and a Mr. Carr. Grammatically, the team should always be called Dick, Carr's Ladies, but the comma usually gets missed out. In 1920, they attracted a crowd of 53,000 to Goodison Park, home of Everton, to watch them play St. Helens Ladies. But then, in 1921, the rotten old FA banned women from playing. Ostensibly, this was on medical grounds because it was feared women would ruin their health by playing football, that it wasn't natural, that it would make them incapable of giving birth. There were also suggestions of financial fiddles to do with gate receipts, as if the men's game was not even more corrupt. The women believed it was just jealousy because their game was proving so popular. It was not until 1971 that the FA finally recognised the women's game. But in the years before and just after the First World War, the women's game was incredibly popular. It featured in magazines and stories and was, in a way, part of the suffragette movement, in that it was an attempt by women to gain more independence and freedom. In 2002, Lily Parr, who was the star striker for Dick Carr's from the age of 14 till her mid-40s, was inducted into the museum's Hall of Fame, their first female player. So Preston figures large in the history of the women's game as well as the men's, and also in football games of the toy variety. The oldest known board football game, amongst the many the museum has on show, turns out to have been made in Preston in 1884. So good old Preston, the national home of our national game. But will it always remain so? You would imagine that what has become in less than 10 years a world-famous museum with the distinction and honour of being termed a national museum would have no worries about its future, attracting 100,000 visitors a year, with a handsome modern building, highly professional staff, lots of events and educational facilities, and 30,000 historic objects. However, being big and national and apparently successful does not guarantee its future any more than the future of our little lawnmower museum is guaranteed. As I discovered when, at the end of my tour, I met Kevin Moore, director of the National Football Museum from the day it first opened. In fact, even earlier, as he was involved in the many dramas that took place before it all kicked off. Kevin was born in Nantwich in 1960. He remembers collecting 1970 World Cup stickers as a boy, the sort where you bought a packet, then tried to swap your doubles with other boys. One day, he got a letter from Gordon Banks, England's goalie, and naturally was well thrilled, till he rushed to school to show off his signed letter and found that half the class had had the same letter. However, it didn't put him off football. He read history at Liverpool, then did an MPhil and worked on a museum project on Merseyside. After a few years, he realised he should have a proper qualification and went off to Leicester to do an MA in museum studies. It was about the first and also the leading place for museum studies, attracting people from all over the world. I remember a man who was deputy head of the National Railway Museum in Zambia, who had left his wife and family for a year to study at Leicester. He said he had to do it or he would never get anywhere in Zambian museums. Kevin then worked in a museum in St. Helens, returning to Leicester as a lecturer. He wrote an academic book on museums and popular culture, arguing that subjects like football and pop music were just as valid for museums to display as any other. It shouldn't be a matter of this is as good as that, but that football or pop music is important in its own right. Museums for too long suffered from stuffiness and elitism, which was why ordinary people were not going there. I still think, by the way, there should be a National Museum of Popular Music. When the campaign for a National Football Museum got going in the early 1990s, he was roped in, and in 1997 was appointed director, even though they still had no funding and no contents. FIFA's Harry Langton collection had never in fact gone to FIFA's headquarters in Switzerland, as I had always imagined, but was in Harry's garage in North London when Kevin first saw it, before it was moved into proper storage, but still in London. One of the many problems we had was that FIFA had bought it in partnership with a US sports company, and they did not agree on what should happen to it. We lost about a year with all the arguments. In the end, we bought the FIFA collection for $580,000 using funding from the Heritage Lottery Fund. That came out of the total of $15 million they received to get them opened and running. But after that, they were on their own, hoping to live by generating income from admissions, the shop, and the cafe. They had projected 80,000 paying visitors, but managed only 40,000. We got tremendous coverage and plaudits for what we had done. I had been determined not to make it into a theme park, some sort of football Disneyland, but to put football in its social context. Though we did have lots of fun and interactive bits. While everyone loved us, no one would give us any more money and not enough people were willing to come to Preston. They had to trim their expenses, which meant no money for things like marketing and publicity, which would have helped them reach their 80,000 target. In 2003, the whole system changed. All national museums were now free to the public. In return for free entry, the museum was to receive a total of £450,000 a year from various football and government funds, leaving them to find £300,000 themselves. They did this by staging corporate events and organising foreign tours, such as exhibiting some of their treasures in Japan during the World Cup. The effect of free entry was immediate. Gates shot up to 100,000 and have stayed there ever since. Of course, they have had to work hard to keep up the excitement and activities, as being in Preston was never going to make it easy for a national museum. In 2008, Lord Morwenny, chairman of the Football League, was quoted as saying that he thought the National Football Museum should in fact be at Wembley, the new Wembley. When it was being constructed, there was a plan to include a museum as part of the new stadium, but nothing seems to have happened. I suspect some of the opposition to Preston over the years has been snobbish, based on the thinking that all such national institutions should be in London, not stuck out in the wastelands of the northwest. It is probably true that visitors would have been more numerous if they had been nearer to London, though in fact, since the museum opened, Preston has been getting nearer to London. In 2001 it took well over 3.5 hours to get to Preston by train from Euston. By 2009 it was down to 2 hours, and is expected to become even quicker in the next few years. Why, soon Preston will be just a suburb of London. What's the problem? Ah, we still have several, sighed Kevin. Even though everyone agrees we have done brilliantly when you think of all the obstacles. Until now. What do you mean? I asked. What's happening now? He'd seemed such a cheerful chap, rather civil servantish in his dark suit, spectacles, and slightly sticky-out ears, but clearly an enthusiast. Why the sudden gloom? It's being announced next week that we are going to have to close. Oh, my God, have I just been round your most wonderful museum going rave, 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 and now you tell me it's going to cease to be? In Preston, probably. I don't see how we can continue here in our present form. Poor old Kevin. For 12 years, since he got the job, which to any football fan in the world would have seemed a dream come true, he had been in constant meetings, battling with endless bureaucrats about funding. Now, the plug was being pulled, mainly by something called the Football Foundation. Apparently, they had been funding them out of their stadium's budget, and now they needed the money for that. I asked why, to make money, they didn't start charging again. Kevin said it wouldn't work. Attendance would probably drop from 100,000 back to 40,000, which would not give them nearly enough income, as they now need 500,000 a year at least. But also, as a national museum, they have to be free. That is the system with all national museums. The upshot was that at the end of 2009, most of the treasures were put into storage. There was a slight possibility that some sort of presence would be kept in Preston, perhaps a small local exhibition, plus the bulk of the artifact collection and the archive, which of course is enormous and would still attract hardy academics and brave researchers more than willing to trail to Preston. But Kevin didn't seem to hold out much hope that that would happen. As for the National Football Museum itself, that would have to find a new home, or close forever. Impossible, I said. I'll sign any petition, storm the barricades, throw stones through the FA windows. Why, I'll even clear space amongst my treasures and look after some of your stuff. That 1872 England-Scotland shirt, that would look good with my collection of England-Scotland programmes. I found it all pretty depressing. Just shows you, a purpose-built museum devoted to a topic the whole world understands and most of the world loves, with national status costing millions to create, with unique and amazing contents attracting crowds of 100,000 every year, and yet, whoosh, it suddenly has to close. What hope, therefore, for all the piddling little museums devoted to one small subject, created by amateurs and run on a shoestring like some of the ones I'd seen? And I was about to see another one, not far away, unless I got too fed up and went into mourning. But it taught me not to envy too much the big purpose-built museums. They can end up with big problems. Best to think small, best to stay modest. If I'm going to display some of my own football treasures, I'd better not boast about them. However, a few weeks later things seemed a bit more optimistic when I met Kevin in London. He was now confident that they had had a serious offer that they were going to accept, subject to various details still to be thrashed out. Manchester City Council have made an offer to relocate the museum to the iconic Urbis building in central Manchester and provide substantially more annual revenue funding than the museum currently operates with. The Urbis building was funded by the Millennium Commission to be a museum and currently houses temporary exhibitions. There would therefore be great benefits for both the National Football Museum and Manchester City Council from this proposal. It could take a year before the new site will be ready, so we football fans will just have to be patient. But it now looks as if at long last the museum's future will be secure. Even better, being in Manchester in a prime location in the middle of a vast metropolitan area and at the centre of a football-mad heartland with famous Premiership clubs all around, attendance figures should shoot up. Kevin thinks that in their new location they will immediately attract 350,000, rising perhaps to 400,000 visitors a year. I can't wait. The National Football Museum, Sir Tom Finney Way, Preston PR1 6PA, telephone 01772 908 421, www.nationalfootballmuseum.com. See conclusion. Chapter 8. The Laurel and Hardy Museum, Ulverston. In the long, hot, humid summer of 2009, there was a photo in most of the newspapers of a statue of Laurel and Hardy being unveiled by the comedian Ken Dodd on a pavement in Ulverston. A nice bit of comic relief from the credit crunch and hard economic times. Probably made many people smile, as the sight of Laurel and Hardy still makes people feel happy, remembering their enjoyment of films past. At their heels, their little dog Laughing Gravy is nipping away at their trousers, all part of the life-size bronze sculpture. Such fun. Such innocence. We were happy then. Yes, it was naive and childlike, and you didn't get bad language or anything nasty at the cinema in those days, not like today. Then people moved on. Ulverston? I wonder how many people took that in and thought, now where's Ulverston when it's at home, and why is there a statue of Laurel and Hardy being put up there? Ulverston is a lovely little town of some 12,000, surprisingly pretty, surprisingly thriving. At least, that's how it feels, wandering round, looking at the shops, the cafes, galleries, indoor market, the nicely painted and preserved buildings. It just happens to be rather remote, stuck in a deep, hidden corner of what was the northern extremes of Lancashire, and is now, since 1974, the southern peninsula of Cumbria. It's not in the Lake District National Park, being too far away, but it is just a short walk from the coast, along a very clean and green little canal to Morecambe Bay. Nearby towns like Millom and Barrow can feel depressing, leftover industrial wastelands, but Ulverston smacks of middle-class care and contentment. Despite its size, it has a cinema and a large, handsome theatre, the Coronation Hall, built in 1915, which seats 600. It does music, arts and literary events, as well as touring shows. That day, so the posters announced, it was going to be Freddie Starr Live, and I'd half thought he was long dead. The Laurel and Hardy statue is in front of the Coronation Hall. There were quite a few couples of a certain age standing in front of it, taking each other's photographs. Naturally, I had my photo taken as well, asking a rather bulky couple to take me with my camera. I then followed them round the corner to the Roxy Cinema, a typical 1930s picture house, still going as a cinema, though most of its vast space has now been carved up to house a nightclub and also, taran taran, Britain's first ever and still only Laurel and Hardy Museum. The museum was the creation of Bill Cubin, who died in 1997. In the 1950s, he had a shop in Ulverston that sold some of the earliest washing machines, and he was known in the town as Billy Twin Tubs. He had previously been a door-to-door salesman, a regular in the RAF, and for a while had a little cafe. None of the ventures made him a lot of money, but when he had any, he spent it on his real passion in life, Laurel and Hardy. "I remember when I was a little girl," says his daughter, Marion, who now runs the museum with her son Mark, "that he told me that Stan Laurel had been born in Ulverston. But I didn't really believe it. At the time, most reference books said he had been brought up in the northeast, in North Shields. There was also a problem about his real name. No one was sure what it was. But my father was insistent, and he managed to dig out Stan's birth certificate, which proved that he was born Arthur Stanley Jefferson on the 16th of June, 1890, at 3 Argyle Street, Ulverston, in the county of Lancashire." Bill Cubin started collecting photos and memorabilia and anything else to do with Laurel and Hardy. When the house of Stan Laurel's birth came up for sale, he didn't have enough money to buy it, which he would have liked to have done, but he managed to acquire most of the furniture, which had once belonged to Stan's grandparents and had been in the house when Stan lived there. Bill shoved the furniture and his other L&H memorabilia into his shop's storeroom. When he acquired any interesting old photos or copies of press cuttings, he stuck them on the walls and ceilings of the storeroom. He joined the Laurel and Hardy fan club, went to Hollywood, met and made friends with other enthusiasts. When they came to visit him, Bill would take them into his storeroom to see his treasures. Local people heard about his collection and they, too, asked to see them. From about the early 1970s, remembers Marion, he started to open up the storeroom on Saturday afternoons and charge people a few pennies to look at his Laurel and Hardy things. Fans came from America to see what he had, and several donated some of their Stan Laurel items. They loved what he was doing and his enthusiasm. It's hard to say exactly when his museum first opened. It was just a hobby at first, then opened in dribs and drabs. I can remember several official openings when I was young, usually when he had acquired something new. Dad was a shameless self-promoter. He was also a strong Tory and served as a local councillor. In 1974, he became the first ever mayor of Ulverston. Ulverston is an ancient town, but the reason why it had never had an official mayor was that it was in the wilds of Lancashire. When it joined the newly created Cumbria, formed from the old counties of Cumberland and Westmorland and a chunk of Yorkshire, its status was upgraded. In 1974 it was allowed to appoint its own mayor, who happened in that first year to be Bill Cubin. Practically the first thing he did as mayor was to have a special plaque put up on Stan Laurel's birthplace. That first plaque got stolen, so another one had to be put up. It was, of course, good publicity for his museum, and Bill was always keen to draw attention to it, cutting many corners to put it on the map. From around 1975 onwards, he began running it as a museum full-time, still in his old storeroom. He managed to cram in a little cinema, with 1920s cinema seats, and showed old Laurel and Hardy films. When kids and teenagers came in, rather sceptical, perhaps not having seen a Laurel and Hardy film before, he would sit them down and say that if any of them did not laugh once during the film, they would get their money back. He never had to pay up. But he did run into some trouble from showing these films. He had assumed that as they were all over 50 years old, they would be out of copyright. "But a new company had appeared on the scene," says Mark, his grandson, "some company who said they had acquired the rights. Grandad got into right legal trouble. He had to hire a solicitor, and the upshot was, I think, he lost about £10,000 in all, more than he was taking from the museum in a year. It did look as if he might have to close, but somehow he managed to survive. He then started showing the films again, but this time said the film show was free. All that people were paying for was entry to his museum. He was a bit of a character, always up to something. But most of all," says Marion, "he was an enthusiast for Laurel and Hardy. He just loved them. Many a time when I was younger, helping out in the museum, I would have to go in front of him and make a wind-up sign. He was talking so much, a queue had formed behind him and people couldn't get in. He then had some unexpected help, when one day a young Dutchman called Nico Monitz, a Laurel and Hardy enthusiast, arrived to look at the museum. Still, just one little room, crammed with stuff, no proper displays. Nico had just won a big prize on a Dutch TV quiz show, and he offered Bill the money to expand his museum, to help him build another room and so double its size. He gave Dad about £1,000 in Dutch money, so we had to exchange, says Marion. It was a generous gift. I asked Mark how many people visited the museum every year, and he said he wasn't sure. All I know is that my mum pays me £8,000 a year to work here. My guess is about £30,000 a year, double what they had in their old premises, where they were for over 30 years. In 2009, the museum moved to what was once the old stage of the Roxy Cinema. They don't have a lot more space, but it is a better shape to exhibit their treasures and in a better position in the town. The old museum was getting tatty and run down, says Marion. It was a struggle running it after my father died, and I wasn't sure about its future. This has been a big step, moving here, and I hope it works, but I thought it was the only way to keep it going. I want Mark to carry on running it, so it needs to attract more people, enough for me to pay him. We're totally self-supporting and get no grants. Marion had been ill, and had heard the news that day that she would soon be confined to a wheelchair, and would therefore not be able to run the museum as she had done. So in future Mark will do it, helped by a volunteer called Alan. Mark had been in the old museum that morning, still taking Laurel and Hardy memorabilia from the walls and ceiling. Some of the things had been put up with wallpaper paste, others with blue tack or drawing pins. It's been hell to get them down, but I'm going to have one wall covered with them in honour of Grandad. You enter the new museum up some narrow angled steps, which were originally the steps up to the main stage of the Roxy. There still is a vague air of a homemade museum, the sort that amateurs create, putting up their own displays and handwritten notices, which of course was how Bill created it in the first place, but they have gone a bit more modern this time. Since moving into their new site, they have got a professional designer in to create an informative series of storyboards, with photos and cuttings, which take you through Stan Laurel's life. Stan's father, Arthur Jefferson, was a music hall comedian turned theatre manager. At the time of Stan's birth in 1890, he had returned to Ulverston, staying with his parents-in-law, having taken on the lease of the local hippodrome and put on variety shows. "There's no money in being a comic," he told young Stan. "You have to get into management." When he moved over to the northeast to take over other theatres, Stan was left for a while with his grandparents in Ulverston, living there until he was about 6. Later on, till he was about 12, he still came to Ulverston for his summer holidays. His father, known as A.J., then moved to Glasgow, where young Stan first trod the boards as a boy actor. He then joined Fred Carno and his company in Manchester. I'd heard of them, but always thought they were a circus. As I used to hear my own father say, it's like Fred Carno's circus in here, whenever we were all making a noise and fighting. It was in fact a music hall troupe, extremely popular, which toured all the main cities and theatres. Carno's real name was Fred Westcott. In 1910, Stan set sail for the USA with Carno's troupe along with the young Charlie Chaplin. For a time, Stan was an understudy to Chaplin, doing the same sort of put-upon-little-man roles. Chaplin, once he reached America, never came back, but Stan did on that first occasion. He did another US tour later, and this time he reached Hollywood and started appearing in silent movies. He changed his name sometime around 1917, during a period of bad luck, when he didn't appear to be making much progress. He decided that it was his name, Stan Jefferson, being 13 letters long, that was holding him back. According to a copy of a letter on the storyboard, a young actress with whom he was then appearing took credit for his new name. She was in a dressing room with him reading a book about Roman emperors, when she noticed that they wore laurel wreaths on their heads. She suggested to Stan that he should call himself Laurel, then he would earn his own laurels. On stage and screen, Stan called himself Laurel from then on, and in 1931, he legally changed his name to Laurel. It was while working for the Hal Roach film studios that Stan first met Oliver Hardy, a jobbing actor doing character parts, though Stan had already become a director. Ollie, however, was always content to do what he was told on the film set and was more interested in playing golf. When asked later on where the ideas had come from or how the stunts had been done, he would reply, "Ask Stan." Oliver Hardy had been born Norvell Hardy in Harlem, Georgia, in 1892, the son of a lawyer with no show business connections in his family. The family had originally come from England, and Ollie maintained he could trace his ancestors back to Admiral Nelson's colleague, Captain Hardy, to whom he is reputed to have said, "Kiss me, Hardy." As a boy, Ollie had a good voice and once thought of becoming a singer, but his weight led to him getting the heavy roles, despite the fact that his nickname was Babe. This originated from a gay Italian barber who fancied him and, every time he had finished shaving him, would rub his cheeks and say, "Nice a baby, nice a baby." This so amused Ollie's friends that they began to call him Babe, and the name stuck with him throughout the whole of his life. They started making Laurel and Hardy films together in 1926. They used their own names from the beginning, which was unusual in those days when film characters were often called things like Lonesome Luke or Hickory Hiram. If the studio sacked you, they could then hire another character actor to play the same role. Laurel and Hardy realized they could always take their own names and characters with them. Stan invariably played the dumb character, but in real life he was the clever one, thinking up gags and stunts. The plot for Duck Soup, one of their classic films made in 1927, is said to have been inspired by a routine Stan remembered his father doing on stage back in his Ulverston days. They made 106 films together, both silent and talking, 20-minute reelers and full-length films, between 1926 and 1954, and were incredibly popular all over the world. They got mobbed when they toured the UK in 1932. They came back in 1947, and Stan visited his birthplace in Ulverston. But alas, Bill Cubin was in the RAF at the time and missed the visit. Hardy died in 1957, but Stan lived on till 1965, supposedly suffering some sort of collapse after the death of his friend and partner. Later, he had a stroke. Hardy was married three times, while Stan managed five marriages, though two of them were to the same woman. When he was very ill in hospital, he told the nurse that he was thinking of going skiing. "I didn't know you were a skier," she said. "I'm not," replied Stan, "but anything is better than lying here having needles stuck in me." Half an hour later, when the nurse returned, Stan had died peacefully in his sleep. Stan, unlike Ollie, was always available and affable, kept his name in the phone book long after he had become world famous, and was always willing to meet fans and talk about his films. "If any of you cry at my funeral," he once said, "I'll never talk to you again." On the walls of the museum are copies of some interesting letters he wrote to his fans, and in little alcoves there is some of the furniture from his grandparents' house, the stuff Bill bought over 30 years ago. One alcove is arranged as an outside washhouse with a huge mangle and a repro 1904 comic in the corner. This is supposed to represent, so Mark explained, the washhouse where young Stan was sent if he was naughty, but he had hidden his comics there so he didn't mind. I said, "Surely they could get a real comic from the 1900s. They're not all that expensive." As a collector, always on the lookout for something new to collect, I offered to look out for a real one and send it on. They don't have a lot of personal belongings from Stan himself. Prices have risen, and there are a lot of wealthy L&H collectors out there in the USA and Germany. What they have is in a little glass showcase. his cigarette lighter, a special ashtray he used after he had had his stroke, his razor, a fiddle he used on stage, his bowler hat, and also some letters and photographs, which were presented by Stan's daughter Lois when she visited the museum. Amongst the Laurel and Hardy souvenirs are bars of soap, a salt and pepper set in the shape of Laurel and Hardy, and some Italian wine bottles also shaped like them. It's always interesting how cheap souvenirs, issued to cash in on a current craze, can in the end become museum exhibits in themselves if the subject continues to be of interest. Laurel and Hardy certainly are. They are regularly rediscovered by new generations and have their films revived. They feature on the cover of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper album, as John Lennon, like millions of other boys and girls in the 1940s and 50s, had watched them at Saturday morning children's cinema shows. In 1991, they appeared on some US stamps. There is today a worldwide fan club, the Sons of the Desert, which has thousands of members and lots of branches known as tents, because you have tents in the desert. This was established in 1964, one of the founders being Dr. John McCabe, who had written a biography of Laurel and Hardy, first published in 1961 and reprinted many times since. "My father used to go over to the USA to their annual conventions," says Marion. "And when people visited his museum and seemed to like it, he would encourage them to start their own tent when they got back home. In the 1970s, when he began the museum, there were only two tents in the UK, one in London and one in Scotland. Thanks to Dad badgering anyone who seemed enthusiastic, there are over 30 tents in the UK today." There's a world conference every 2 years, and in 1984 it was held in Ulverston, the first time it had been held outside the USA. There's also a European conference and a regular British national conference. They had just had the annual UK one in Ulverston, which attracted 125 members. There are also a couple of magazines in the UK and the USA. In Harlem, Georgia, Hardy's birthplace, there is a Laurel and Hardy museum similar to the one in Ulverston. So what's the attraction? "Oh, well, Laurel and Hardy is such fun," says Marion. "Gentle humour with no vulgarity. Everyone knows a Hardy figure, the one who thinks he's clever but he's not. And we all know someone we think pretty slow and dumb. Most of us know a relation who bumps into things. Generations grew up remembering their films from their childhood, but now you can see the films on telly or buy them in boxed sets from the internet. They're just as popular as they have ever been." I said I had noticed quite a few people outside on the pavement having their photos taken in front of the new statue, proof they were still loved. "That statue was my father's idea, something like 20 years ago. He tried so hard to get approval for it, and then to get the money, but he died in 1997 without ever managing it. I hadn't really got the heart to take it on, but at his funeral some members of the Sons of the Desert offered to take on the task of fundraising. We applied to all the usual places for grants, including the National Lottery. It took years of form-filling, but no one would give us a penny. All we wanted was a straightforward statue of them, as everyone knows them, not any artistic interpretation of their art. If we'd gone for something arty, I think we might have got funding from some arts body. In the end, the Sons of the Desert raised £60,000, all by themselves. That paid for the sculptor, Graham Ibbison, and to have it cast in bronze. Every time I go past it, I can't believe we eventually did it. I did used to dream about it. My dad would have been so pleased. I see it as a monument to him, and what he did for the town by opening this museum, as well as a monument to Laurel and Hardy themselves." It is also a monument to amateur enthusiasm, creating something for other enthusiasts, something that never existed before and that no one had ever thought of doing, overcoming all the problems, legal and financial, that beset such homemade enterprises and have to be solved without any outside help. I'd like to pinch the idea of showing old films when I get round to my own museum, such as Beatles films. They would go down well. What am I saying? I must be mad. The lawyers would have a field day. I'd spend the rest of my life in court. So far, a lot of my museums have been like the Laurel and Hardy one, a do-it-yourself, go-it-alone museum. like the vintage wirelesses, fans, lawnmowers, baked beans. The Postal Museum, you could argue, was not quite in that mould, not totally unusual or seen as daft by other people, as stamps are an established mainstream hobby. The Beatles, well, for a start, their name has enormous pulling power. Football, likewise, has always had a massive following, so in theory it should not be all that bizarre or difficult to create and run a football museum. In theory. In practice, we now know otherwise. Coming up, folks, something totally different. A museum spawned by an industry. Laurel and Hardy Museum. On stage at the Roxy, Brogden Street, Ulverston, Cumbria, LA 12, 7AH. Telephone 01229 582292. www.laurel-and-hardy.co.uk. Chapter 9. The Cumberland Pencil Museum, Keswick. About 25 years ago, I took my children to the Cumberland Pencil Museum in Keswick. A wet day, probably. Something to do while we waited for it to clear so we could take the steamer across Derwent Water and climb Catbells. It hadn't long opened, so it was still something of a novelty, but I'd been dying to go for a long time as I thought it was so unusual, eccentric and funny. How could there be a whole museum devoted to something as small and simple as a pencil? I was delighted with it, came away raving, which I tend to do quite often, as my wife frequently warns me. I will oversell things, she says, which can rebound when other people then expect too much. My children, alas, were less than impressed, couldn't see why I'd found it so interesting. The entrance fee in 1984 was 60 pence, for I have it in my diary, and that year they attracted 17,000 visitors. I remember it as small, fairly dusty, with low cases, one containing a Second World War pencil that particularly fascinated me. Just been back for the first time since, and it was raining again this time, but goodness, what a difference. There were queues outside, as if it was a football match, and I half expected touts to be selling tickets. Instead, there was free entertainment, jugglers amusing the crowds, most of them families with young children, as they waited, while at the little covered entrance hall, an artist was doing cartoons with what appeared to be watercolour paints. Yet I thought it was supposed to be a museum of pencils, not painting. Inside it was heaving, so much activity, so much going on, so many attractions. And there was also now an excellent and attractive cafe, doing light meals as well as drinks and snacks. No wonder, today the Pencil Museum attracts 100,000 visitors a year. It is still the only one of its type in the world, and it still makes people smile at the very idea of it, imagining, as I did, that it must be a bit of a joke, not to be taken seriously. "The average visitor still has little idea what to expect," says Alex Spencer, the curator. "They pick up a leaflet at the tourist office in the Moot Hall, or get told about it when they ask what else there is to do on a bad day. They come along expecting to stay half an hour, and end up staying 2 hours. We've done surveys, and we know this is true. That's the average duration." It's not just the fun and the interactive elements that keep the punters amused for those 2 hours, but the discovery that pencils are a fascinating subject, part of Cumbria's, and in fact Britain's, social and economic history. Oh yes. The first discovery in the world of graphite took place around the early 1500s in the Borrowdale Valley near Keswick. Graphite is a natural form of pure carbon. The other, much harder version is diamonds, but alas, we have not found many of these so far in Cumbria. According to local mythology, after a violent storm during which trees had been uprooted, some shepherds found that lumps of blackish rock had been exposed. They thought at first it was coal. They failed to get it to burn, but found it was ideal for marking their sheep. Sometime later, another use was found for it. making cannonballs using graphite moulds, as the graphite did not melt at high temperatures. These were vital armaments during the Elizabethan age. Stagecoaches took the graphite under armed guard to London, where, at the Tower of London, then an arsenal, the cannonballs were made. Graphite was also used for medicinal purposes. During the 16th century, there was a sort of mini gold rush in the Borrowdale Valley. Graphite mines were opened, and miners, used to digging such materials, brought in from Germany, who then settled down and over the centuries became Cumbrians, which is why today you get quite a few German-sounding surnames in the Keswick area. When I was at school in Carlisle, there was a boy called Rheinbeck, whose ancestors had probably been German miners. I've often wondered if Paul Scholes, the Manchester United footballer, had a similar background. Locally, the graphite was known as wad, and when it was used for marking or writing, it was known as a wad pencil. Originally, after the discovery by the shepherds, a piece of graphite, which is easy to cut and shape, was simply wrapped in a piece of sheepskin to be used for marking. The Italians are the ones first recorded as using Cumberland graphite encased in wood. During the Renaissance, graphite from Cumberland was greatly prized all over Europe, by artists in the Low Countries and then in Italy, and was used by Michelangelo and other old masters when doing their drawings. Graphite was therefore very valuable, so much so that guards were kept on the mines and the miners were searched after they came off a shift. All the same, there was an illegal trade in lumps of black wad smuggled out of the mines, most of which centred around the bar of the George Hotel in Keswick. This illegal trade was known as the black market, a phrase that has passed into the language. So, not only did Cumbrian graphite help the old masters, and many of our great lady novelists who did much of their early scribbling in pencil at the kitchen table, but it has had an influence on the English language. Quite an achievement for such a humble substance, which over the centuries has hardly changed its shape, its size, its purpose. Early pencil making, using a wood casing, was for many years purely a cottage industry in the Keswick area. It was easy to do, using minimal tools and machines, and could be done in ordinary farmhouses. And in essence, the manufacturing process is still much the same today. Most visitors to the Pencil Museum, if they've ever thought about the subject, if asked how the lead gets into a pencil, would probably say, isn't it done by boring a little hole through a bit of wood and then shoving the lead through? In fact, a pencil consists of two halves, stuck together. A piece of wood has a ridge made in it, the lead is inserted, then an identical piece of wood is stuck on the top. But so well done, so skillfully, that you can't see the joins, especially if the pencil is then varnished or painted. The shaping of the lead, the cutting of the wood, and the sticking together could therefore be done by almost anyone at home, using a saw and a chisel. But of course, pretty slowly. Pencil factories arrived with the Industrial Revolution, and the Cumberland Pencil Company, which owns and runs the Pencil Museum, dates back to 1832. For many years, there were four main pencil factories in the town. But by around the 1900s, after various takeovers and closures, there was only one left, which formally became the Cumberland Pencil Company in 1916. David Sharrock, today's managing director, joined the company as an accountant in March 1981, just a few months before the museum opened. I can't really take credit for it, as it had already been penciled in. It was there on the drawing board, he says, getting in the jokes before anyone else can, as of course he has heard all the possible pencil jokes by now. Over the decades, there had always been a steady stream of visitors asking to see round the pencil works, including royal visitors, but health and safety regulations were coming in, making it harder to allow the general public into the actual workshops, so they opened a small museum on the same site and put on display some of their extensive archives. At the time, we were the only visitor attraction in Keswick, apart from the town museum in Fitz Park, which wasn't exactly a massive attraction. Keswick Museum used to be very fuddy-duddy and old-fashioned, with the usual mixed collections of unrelated stuff given to them over the years and shoved in dusty display cabinets, typical of many small-town local museums across the country. In Keswick's case, they did have some truly exotic items, such as a 500-year-old dead cat, the original manuscript of